Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. In Ukraine, the country's farmers and smallholders urgently need more support to avoid a food crisis, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, said on Wednesday, as it announced a $15.5 million initiative to help them. With funding from the European Union, the project will help to keep agricultural production going in Ukraine, after the Russian invasion last February led to the destruction of crops and farm equipment and disruption to supply chains. Local and displaced populations in western Ukraine are among those who need help in the short term, amid rising food insecurity, FAO said. The UN agency also noted that in a recent nationwide assessment, one in four people had reduced or halted agricultural production because of the war. FAO explained that as the war continues, a large number of households, family farms, individual producers and others have found it increasingly difficult to continue operating. Major challenges expected in the next few months in crop and livestock farming include low sale prices at market, a lack of fertilizers and pesticides, and shortages of fuel or electricity to power equipment. UN Human Rights Chief Volker Türk on Wednesday urged governments to reach into your hearts and end arbitrary detention. He called on governments and all detaining authorities globally to amnesty, pardon, or simply release all those detained for exercising their rights. The High Commissioner for Human Rights urged them to review the detention of environmental and climate activists and of those fighting discrimination, along with anyone speaking up against abuses and corruption, journalists jailed for doing their essential work, and human rights defenders. Freeing them would be in line with the vision of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is 75 years old this year, Mr. Türk explained, as he highlighted its call for a world in which all people live free and equal in dignity and rights. To the UN Security Council, where five countries joined its ranks as non-permanent members for the next 2 years. Ecuador, Malta, Mozambique, Japan and Switzerland will have their say, alongside the five permanent and veto-wielding members, China, France, Russia, the United States and the United Kingdom. The remaining members of the 15-strong body are Albania, Brazil, Gabon, Ghana and the United Arab Emirates. They began their terms as non-permanent members of the Council last year. Japan holds the rotating presidency of the Security Council for January, which will see meetings on several situations of international concern, such as the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or DPRK, Palestine, West Africa and the Sahel, and Yemen. The devastating impact of Syria's long-running conflict is also on the Council's agenda, with scheduled political, humanitarian, and chemical weapons updates expected from top UN officials. Council members are also expected to vote on a draft resolution confirming the extension of the Syria cross-border aid delivery mechanism. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Good afternoon. You are welcome here at Radio Free Kansas, and there will be considerable time for call for callers. You can call in and comment on the current day three, the third day of the vote for Speaker of the House. And as it stands right now, we'll have a live feed courtesy to the Midas Network, and they give you great commentary as we go through our regular programming. I'll be back with you after the latest this morning's Democracy Now! headlines.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House of Representatives has adjourned for a second consecutive day without swearing in members of the 118th Congress after lawmakers once again failed to elect a new House Speaker. On Wednesday, the House held three more rounds of voting. In each one, Republican leader Kevin McCarthy failed to muster the 218 votes needed after 20 members of his party instead backed Byron Donalds of Florida. Until a speaker is elected, the House cannot perform any other actions or swear in any Congress member. Mississippi Congressmember Trent Kelly joined other Republicans calling on members of his party's far-right Freedom Caucus to drop their opposition to McCarthy.
But we've asked and we've asked, what is it you want? What do you need? But you have 20 people demanding the unconditional surrender of, including this group of warriors. We will not unconditionally surrender. Tell us what you want. We might surrender if you tell us the terms, but just so you know, we're in the strong position. There's 201 of us and 20 of them.
After headlines, we'll go to Capitol Hill for the latest with Representative-elect Greg Kassar of Texas, who's still waiting to be sworn in, as well as every other Congress member. In California, Governor Gavin Newsom has declared a state of emergency and ordered evacuations as a cyclone slammed into the San Francisco Bay Area Wednesday night with hurricane-force winds and torrential downpours. California's second major storm this week is expected to wreak havoc across the state, including flooding, landslides, and dangerous winds. A young child was killed in Sonoma County when a tree fell on the family home. Over 180,000 customers had lost power by early this morning. This is a resident of Santa Cruz County in Northern California.
We get home last night, and first thing we did was pack our stuff off the floor and, you know, all the important stuff, gather it, you know, get some luggage ready just in case, and get some sandbags for the possible evacuation.
California has been experiencing a series of extreme weather events known as atmospheric rivers, which have been described as rivers in the sky, unleashing unrelenting storms. Scientists say climate change will continue to increase the intensity of these storms. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces have shot and killed a Palestinian teenager during a raid on the city of Nablus. The Palestinian Health Ministry reports 16-year-old Amr Abu Zaytoun was the fourth Palestinian child killed by Israeli forces since the start of the new year. Elsewhere, Israel's military has begun demolishing homes, water supplies, and olive orchards in Musafa Yatta in the occupied West Bank near Hebron. This week, Israeli armored vehicles company demolition crews as they razed homes and farms in two villages. Last year, the Israeli High Court of Justice approved the home demolitions, which will uproot more than 1,000 people. In Washington, D.C., Palestinian-American U.S. Congressmember Rashida Tlaib tweeted, "Not even 1 week into 2023, Israel's new far-right apartheid government is moving to ethnically cleanse entire communities, which would displace more than 1,000 Palestinian residents, including 500 children, all with American backing, bulldozers and bullets," she tweeted. The Anglican Church has expressed dismay over an attack on a Christian cemetery close to Jerusalem's walled Old City. Security camera footage taken on New Year's Day shows two men entering the graveyard, toppling a cross-shaped tombstone, smashing it to pieces. More than 30 grave sites were damaged. Jerusalem's Anglican Archbishop called the desecration a clear hate crime carried out by, quote, Jewish extremists. The incident came days after Israel swore in the most far-right government in its history, led by ultra-religious and ultra-nationalist members. Palestinian Ambassador Riyad Mansour addressed the incident at the United Nations Wednesday.
You've seen by now that there are crosses over, you know, graveyards being trampled upon and attacked by extreme settlers. This is a toxic environment. The international community has to speak with one voice in rejecting this extremism, in rejecting those terrorists and those elements of fascists in the Israeli government.
The UN Security Council has scheduled an emergency meeting at the request of the UN's Palestinian delegation after Israel's new national security minister, the ultra-nationalist politician Itamar Ben-Gvir, visited the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied East Jerusalem. In Washington, D.C., U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price was critical of Ben-Gvir's visit, which other nations have condemned as a provocative act.
We stand firmly for preservation of the historic status quo with respect to the holy sites in Jerusalem. Any unilateral actions that depart from that historic status quo is unacceptable.
Back in the United States, newly released documents reveal the Pentagon's top general had to dissuade senior Trump administration officials from attempting to court-martial retired military officers who wrote editorials critical of Donald Trump. That's one of dozens of new revelations from testimony by Joint Chiefs Chair General Mark Milley to the House January 6 Committee, made public this week in a 300-page transcript. Among other revelations, General Milley ordered his staff to preserve what he called boatloads of documents about the January 6 attack for future investigations. And General Milley told Congress there were indications Trump was contemplating issuing unlawful orders to the military. A European regulator has ruled Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, illegally forced users to accept personalized ads. Meta is appealing Wednesday's ruling, which ordered the social media giant to pay $414 million in fines and to allow customers to opt out of so-called behavioral ads. Meanwhile, Twitter said Wednesday it will once again allow political advertisements after former CEO Jack Dorsey banned all political ads on Twitter worldwide in 2019. This comes as Twitter's new owner, Elon Musk, struggles to retain advertisers, and after Twitter recently relaxed its COVID-19 misinformation policy and restored the accounts of thousands of banned users. Amazon CEO has announced plans to cut more than 18,000 jobs. They're the largest layoffs in Amazon's history, representing some 6% of the retail giant's 300,000 workers. Meanwhile, Salesforce announced plans to lay off 10% of its workforce. U.S. tech companies cut more than 150,000 jobs in 2022. President Biden said he'll visit the U.S.-Mexico border next week as part of his upcoming trip to Mexico. It will be Biden's first visit to the border since taking office and comes amidst mounting fallout from the extension of the Trump-era Title 42 by the Supreme Court as Republicans challenge the policy, which has been used to expel over 2 million people at the border since March 2020. Biden is expected to focus on securing the U.S. southern border, leading to fears of further militarization and abuses against asylum seekers. Thousands of migrants have sought asylum in Mexico in recent weeks over fears the U.S. would keep Title 42 in place. This is an asylum seeker from Honduras.
Some of us came here pregnant, since the Honduran economy cannot support our needs. What we want is asylum in the United States, and to go to a shelter that can support us, so that our family in the U.S. can help us with the little that they have.
In other immigration news, Canada added a record 431,000 new permanent residents last year. Immigrant residents make up nearly all of Canada's labor force growth. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's government is seeking to add 500,000 new permanent residents in 2025. President Biden met with the family of hospitalized NFL player Damar Hamlin in Cincinnati Wednesday after the Buffalo Bills star suffered a cardiac arrest on the field during a game Monday. Hamlin remains in critical condition in an ICU at the University of Cincinnati Medical Center. On Wednesday, Biden was asked by a reporter if the NFL was getting too dangerous.
I don't know how you avoid it. I think working like hell on the helmets and the concussion protocols, that all makes a lot of sense. But it's, it is dangerous. You got to just acknowledge it.
A federal judge in Boston has sentenced the mastermind of a college admission scam to 3.5 years in prison over a scheme where wealthy parents paid exorbitant bribes to secure spots for their unqualified children in prestigious universities. In some cases, photos were staged or doctored to make the teenagers seem like accomplished athletes. William Rick Singer received the sentence Wednesday, nearly 3 years after he pleaded guilty to criminal charges, including racketeering, money laundering, and obstruction of justice. Singer's clients included Hollywood stars Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin, and Bill McGlashan, founder of TPG Capital, one of the largest private equity investment firms in the world. Here in New York, thousands of Uber drivers are on a 24-hour strike today. They're demanding the ride-hailing corporation drop its lawsuit aimed at stopping a pay raise approved by the Taxi and Limousine Commission. The New York Taxi Workers Alliance says drivers were cheated out of $12 million in pay in late December after Uber refused to implement pay raises that were supposed to go into effect. And in other news from New York, the NYPD is facing new backlash after officers escorted members of the far-right Proud Boys to a subway station, apparently helping them evade their fares after they sought to disrupt a drag story hour, a popular reading event for children at a Queens library in late 2022.
Proud Boys don't have to pay for the fare.
Special, thank you.
You don't have to pay for the fare.
Appreciate it from your tax.
Proud Boys don't have to pay for the fare.
Oh, thank you.
That is insane. Proud Boys don't have to pay for the fare.
$3.
Oh, I have to pay for the fare, but they don't?
Right.
Is that the situation you're saying?
That's correct.
New York City authorities have been cracking down on fare evasion, flooding subway stations with police, and leading to assaults on passengers and arrests. In related news, a police officer has been suspended after a video emerged of him beating a teenage girl near a Staten Island middle school Tuesday. Police say the attack occurred after two officers attempted to break up a fight among a group of girls. On Wednesday, New York Mayor Eric Adams, himself a former police captain, said he was not pleased with what he saw in the video, but Mayor Adams claimed New Yorkers continue to trust the police.
I don't care who you are. You could be the staunchest critic of a police officer, but you know three numbers in this city, 911. And you're happy when they pull up. You are happy to see them late at night. You're happy if your child is out somewhere knowing that they're on the street. These incidents are not going to erode the relationship that the people of the city have with the men and women of the New York City Police Department.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
Well, there you have it. That's this morning's War and Peace Report from Amy Goodman at democracynow.org. While this is our programs are playing, I'm happy to announce that, well, I don't know if I'm happy, but it is a fact. Representative from Florida, Matt Gaetz, just voted for Donald Trump as Speaker of the House. The Bannon plan, Steve Bannon's plan, was to have Donald Trump as Speaker of the House, and it seems this is the first sign. C-SPAN this morning reported that Lauren Boebert, I don't know how to pronounce her name, of Colorado, did say she was going to nominate Trump for Speaker of the House later today. Gaetz, from Florida, jumped the gun a little bit and voted for Trump. The vote category called others in the tally. And the McCarthy, Representative McCarthy, did not get enough votes to be Speaker. And it is, they're going for their, let's see, I think it's their eighth vote. Yes, they will go into their eighth vote today. And they're now taking a break and getting ready for the eighth vote. Kevin McCarthy, once again, has lost the seventh vote of the third day. And we're going to proceed with our regular programming. We have plenty of time after the Law and Disorder Radio episode to have you guys on. If you'd like to call in, you can call in at area code 646-716-8652. And I'll be running live audio, from the Midas Touch Network, which has some great commentary. And let's go on with the show. We'll see you in the second hour.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Professor Andrew Ross from New York University on the new book that has just been published by Orr Books called Cars and Jails, Freedom Dreams, Debt, and Carcerality. It's a real eye-opener. and Heidi Bogosian and I speak about Michael Ratner, the founder of our show, the former president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Michael passed away 6 years ago, but several weeks after he died, Heidi and I spoke about his contribution.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Bogosian.
What's the connection between cars and jails? Every day, more than 50,000 Americans are pulled over by police officers while driving. Most of them will come away from the encounter owing money to the municipality or the county in which they were stopped. Some will be arrested. They will join the nearly 9 million Americans to cycle through our country's jails each year. Police can choose from hundreds of traffic code violations to make a pretext stop and conduct a vehicle search. This may result in a fine or even arrest. American consumer law has long held that the automobile is a freedom machine, consecrating the mobility of a free people. Yet paradoxically, the car also functions at the crossroads of two great systems of unfreedom and immobility, the credit economy and the American carceral system. We speak today about this situation with Andrew Ross, who along with his co-author, Julie Livingston, has investigated this paradox and written the book Cars and Jails, Freedom Dreams, Debt, and Carcerality. It's just been published by Orr Books. The book shows how the long arms of debt and carceral state operate in tandem in the daily life of car use and ownership. Andrew Ross is a professor of social and cultural analysis at NYU, New York University, and a social activist and analyst. He has authored and edited numerous books and has written for the New York Times, The Guardian, The Nation, and Al Jazeera. Andrew Ross, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, it's terrific being able to interview you, Andrew. Cars and Jails, Freedom Dreams, Debt, and Carcerality is a really terrific book. I've just finished reading it. I recommend it to everybody. Orr Books published it. And I want to ask you about the book. We've got about 25 minutes, Andrew. Let me ask you this. You and Julie Livingston have written the book, Cars and Jails. What's the relationship between cars and jails?
Oh, there's so many of them. This is what we discovered in the course of writing the book. But basically, the book is about all of the ways in which car ownership and car use are entangled with the criminal justice system and also with the debt system. In other words, all of the ways in which financialization, which is a primary mode of capital accumulation in our economy these days, how the debt economy also bites in, takes a big bite out of household income for car ownership and car use.
Yeah, I was surprised to see that the amount of debt that people owe on their cars is almost equal to the over $1 trillion amount of debt that students owe.
It doesn't get the same kind of attention as student debt does. I've been active in the student debt cancellation movement myself for 10 years, so I've contributed to that scrutiny of student debt. But auto loan debt has actually doubled in the last 10 years, and it's creeping up there towards, you know, the aggregate levels of student debt. And there are, you know, the primary reasons for that were the entry of subprime lending, just predatory in nature, into the market, and also the elongation of loan terms to 84 months or longer. The average loan term now is 72 months. And so the upshot is that a monthly average car loan payments have been really rapidly increasing. They're now more than a whopping $700 a month. That doesn't include insurance, of course. That doesn't include basic maintenance costs. And also, what is very profitable from the point of view of financing is what's called the after parts business. If you need a new battery, you need a new transmission system, you need a new set of tires, these are all things that you can get financed to So all of these debts add up and contribute to the overall debt burden.
You know, there's some sympathy for students, I guess a moral sympathy, because students are contributing to the society, and why should they be burdened by this huge debt when their knowledge is going to go into making things better? But you don't have the same kind of sympathy for people that borrow money on cars, do you? Even though cars are important for the economy as well.
That's absolutely right, and that's hopefully this book can help to change some of that mentality, because, you know, the way I see it is that education is a public good, it's a social good, along with housing and along with health care. But transportation is also a public good, but it's not necessarily always seen that way, and it certainly has never been funded that way in this country. And we don't have a movement now for student debt cancellation and student debt reduction. College for All is the slogan. We also have Housing for All, which is the housing justice slogan, and Medicare for All, I guess, is the healthcare movement slogan. We don't yet have a movement for transportation for all, although we absolutely do need one. We need to think about transportation as a public good up there along with these others.
For those of you who've just tuned in, I'm speaking with Professor Andrew Ross from New York University. He and Julie Livingston have written just published book, Cars and Jails, Freedom Dreams, Debt, and Carcerality. Andrew, you use the concept of carceral state in the book. What is that?
Well, that's a term that that describes the kind of society we increasingly live on, where the prison industrial complex, what people often refer to as the prison industrial complex, which is a massively profitable enterprise, occupies an ever greater portion of regional economies and state economies, but also where a lot of the techniques of punishment and control and surveillance, which are central to criminal justice, have become much more prevalent and pervasive in society at large. One example is, and we devote a whole chapter to this in our book, is the extension of surveillance of all of us through automobiles. These days, cars are spying on us, quite frankly. There's a computer hidden inside the console, and it's documenting and gathering data on all of our conduct, our locations, sometimes our phone conversations, and it sends that data to the car makers, who will sell that data on the open market to anyone who wants to buy it, not just government agencies and police departments, but corporations. Just one example of this extensive surveillance system which operates through the car and basically is a dragnet for all of us.
Yeah, one of the reasons that the intelligence, quote, community went after Edward Snowden was that he released information about how cell phones were used to spy on us and household appliances can be used to spy on us. And now we have cars that can spy on us. It's really extraordinary. Andrew Ross, what's the role played by automobiles in the disproportionate incarceration of black, brown, and poor people? And why is the automobile a trap that impoverishes and captures people with devastating consequences for their lives?
Well, this is very well documented, Michael, that, you know, the disproportionate number of traffic stops that, you know, sends people into prison, the disproportionate number of fines and tickets and punishments and debts they accumulate along the way, the disproportionate high interest rates that are attached to auto loans for black buyers in particular, or buyers of color. These are all pretty well documented. What we try in the book, however, what we try to do is show how systematic these things are. They're not, you know, there's sort of random money grabs on the part of individuals or small firms or large corporations, they are part of a system in which the carceral economy intersects with the debt economy. And in particular, it preys upon poor people and disproportionately minorities. And these are the people who end up in prison overwhelmingly. I teach in a prison education program, and I regular contact with that population, and that's who they are.
Well, you bring me to my next question, Andrew Ross. Cars and Jails was researched and written under the auspices of the NYU Prison Education Program Research Lab. A number of formerly incarcerated people were involved as researchers within the project. Please talk about what these people did. Is this really a unique project, isn't it?
Well, I'd love to talk about that, Michael. We offer a two-year associate's degree in Walcombe Men's Prison in Ulster County. It's about 2 hours north of New York City. And when our guys are released, we get scholarships for some of them to continue on at NYU in New York to finish their four-year degrees. And some of them we train as researchers. We call them peer researchers because most of what they do is go out in the field and interview formerly incarcerated peers. So it's a kind of innovative research or a data gathering model, if you like. So a lot of the interviews fed into the research we did for this book. The initial interviews, we noticed that people talked about cars all the time, how they dreamt about cars in prison, you know, regaining their freedom and hitting the open road when they got released, or their nostalgia for the glamorous life on wheels before they were incarcerated. And then a strange thing happened, which turned out to be a very important clue for us. One of our peer researchers got arrested on a minor traffic violation and reincarcerated. The same thing then happened to another, and a similar thing happened to a third. And then we began to get a sense from our direct experience of how this cycle of incarceration and reincarceration involves automobiles very directly as a vehicle of capture and control. And that's why we decided then to launch the bigger project, which led to the book itself.
Andrew, you cite a figure that was shocking to me. You wrote that 50,000 Americans are pulled over by police every day. These stops can be pretextual stops. What's a pretextual traffic stop, and why is this legal?
There's a long history behind that question, Michael. You know, it has to do with the rapid growth of police departments in the 1920s, which was largely due to the need to monitor traffic safety. So you saw this jump a very substantial jump in the growth of police departments. And then there was a long debate in the courts, which lasted over the course of a few decades, about how the Fourth Amendment guarantee against unreasonable searches would apply to vehicles on the road. And ultimately, because the road is considered public, considered a different environment from a private home, the courts agreed to give a huge amount of discretionary authority to the police to conduct these searches and seizures on the pretext of some violation. And the stops routinely are done on the pretext of a traffic code violation, but they lead to more intensive searches and seizures. So the 50,000 stops a day, some of them result in fatalities if the driver has the wrong skin color. Many more result in arrests and lead to detention. But most of them, the majority of these stops, result in traffic tickets, which is a form of punishment and a form of what we call state debt, where the state is the creditor.
If a person buys a car, and in most cases they buy it on credit, and then can't pay off the car, what happens? Why do you say, and you've got a chapter called Why Do So Many Owe So Much, why is driving a car a tightly sprung debt trap, as you call it?
Well, first of all, unless you live in a, you know, a dense urban neighborhood where with easy access to decent public transit, you absolutely need a car. It's sort of mandatory in the U.S. Car ownership is compulsory, so there's nothing optional about going into debt in order to buy a car, and by far the majority of car purchases are financed. The average cost of a car now is $40,000. Sooner or later, because of the rise of subprime lending, if you don't have a steady or a high income, you're going to end upside down on your loan, which is to say you owe more than the car is worth. So what you do then is you fold the balance into a new loan, which is a much higher interest rate, after your car is sold or repossessed. Now, if you're formally incarcerated, you're red meat for lenders and dealers when you walk into a dealership, because your credit score is going to be shot from years of inactivity, and you're basically at the mercy, much more at the mercy than the rest of us. You're much more at the mercy of these predatory lenders. So you're going to walk out of that, walk out of the lot, or drive out of the lot with a car you can't afford. And we found this in case after case in our interviews, people driving, having acquired fairly expensive cars and finding it easier to do that than find an apartment they could rent, because the dealers will only finance expensive cars for them. They won't sell you a Honda, they'll sell you a Mercedes. And the consequences of that are devastating, because they know they're going to repossess that car in a year or two and then sell it to some other sap. That's how the system works.
And you've documented that in this very fine book, Cars and Jails, Freedom Dreams, Debt, and Carcerality. Julie Livingston and Andrew Ross wrote the book. We're speaking on Law and Disorder with Andrew Ross. Andrew, I understand the book is available from OR Books. That's orbooks.com. And I wanted to ask you a question that's really troubled me since I read the book. Can American citizens actually go to jail or prison for owing money?
Technically, no, because debtors' prisons were abolished in 1833. But the back door to the debtor's prison has been wide open for a long, long time. And here's how it works, Michael. If you have an unpaid civil debt judgment, or actually owe the state money in the form of traffic debt, you'll end up in court, and the creditor will issue a number of calls for debtors' examinations, what are called debtors' examinations, and sooner or later, you're not going to be able to take a day off work. You're going to miss a court appearance. At that point, the creditor pressures or lobbies the judge to issue a contempt of court for failure to appear. So by far, the majority of detentions that result or probations that result come from that contempt of court. It's basically an arrest warrant. And those kinds of cases are filling up small claims courts across the country, paradoxically.
That's really amazing. Andrew, talk about how traffic fines are used to partially finance city and municipality budgets.
Well, this is a terrible story. I mean, it became more publicly known after the unrest in Ferguson several years ago when it became pretty obvious that the city was basically financing its budgets from traffic tickets and fines and fees. We've all been caught in a speed trap, or most of us have been caught in a speed trap when a local municipality will set artificially low speed limits and then to catch unsuspecting motorists. That has a long history, but in recent decades, that kind of what's called revenue policing has become much more systematic, and it's basically in many jurisdictions it's a primary means of meeting local budgets for not just for courts and law enforcement, but for general operating budgets. It's a terrible way of funding governments, and it's a regressive form of taxation. because the fine and fee system in this country is flat fee. Everyone gets the same ticket. If you are a high income motorist, it's not going to be a deterrent, and it's not going to make much difference at all to your pocketbook. But if you're a low income motorist, it can have devastating consequences, because these kinds of fines and tickets can cascade into much larger sums, from penalties and late fees and surcharges and so on and so forth, and ultimately can lead to detention.
So, Andrew Russ, how would you overhaul the traffic policing?
Well, the easiest way, and has been done in a few jurisdictions, is to withdraw armed police officers from the business of traffic safety. The other thing really to do is to make sure that if people do end up in court as a result of traffic fines, excessive policing, then the courts and their judges have to consider ability to pay, which is the law of the land, but in many local courts and municipalities, that's not the case. The judges don't consider your ability to pay. And that's a big problem. And then there's the issue of the arrest warrants. No judge should be allowed to issue arrest warrants for unpaid civil debt judgments.
How would you change auto financing?
Well, auto financing is almost completely unregulated. I mean, it's barely regulated. And there are many private workarounds for the usury caps. Every state has a limit, a usury cap, on how much interest can be charged. But there's all sorts of workarounds and loopholes that are used by lenders. In New York State, for example, there's something called the retail installment contract. It's basically a euphemism for an auto loan, and it's a way of getting around the 16% usury cap in New York State. They don't call it a loan, they call it a retail installment contract, so you can go higher, and the criminal cap is 25% in New York State. So you find a lot of subprime lenders are issuing loans at 24.99%. They call them retail installment contracts, however. That's just one example of the loopholes.
We're speaking with Andrew Russ, who's co-written with Julie Livingston a really scintillating breakthrough book, Cars and Jails, Freedom Dreams, Debt, and Carcerality. The book is available at OrBooks, OrBooks.com. Andrew, I recently saw two maps, one of Europe and one of America, placed side by side. And the maps showed public transportation in terms of railroads and trolley lines, buses. The map of Europe had so many lines on it that it blotted out the color of the map, but the map of America had only a few lines on it. What would it take to change the transportation system in the United States?
Well, that's a huge challenge because it's the autocentric build-out of infrastructure in the U.S. after the war was so systematic and so comprehensive. That's why, you know, car ownership is so compulsory across the country. There's an 80 to 20% split in terms of transit funding, transportation funding from Congress. 80% goes to infrastructure that facilitate car use, and only 20% goes to public transit. We would need to reverse those numbers to begin with to see any significant difference in infrastructure investment. That did not happen as a result of the recent Biden administration bills, the infrastructure and the climate bills, which further entrenched car use, in my view, for the next 30 or 40 years or so. There was an opportunity to turn that around, and that was a missed opportunity in those administration bills. That would just be the start, and that's just the funding part of it. Then there's also the mentality piece of it, Michael. And that's more difficult because the car.
But the consequences of all these cars on the road is climate change, actually, and that's something they're just not addressing adequately. Well, Andrew Ross, unfortunately, we've run out of our allotted time on Law and Disorder, but I wanted to thank you for being on the show. Cars and Jails, Freedom Dreams, Debt, and Carcerality is a book that's just been published by Orr Books. That's orrbooks.com. You and Julie Livingston have written it. It's a real breakthrough book. I congratulate you for writing this book. It's an important book, especially for people that are involved in the abolition movement for prisons, and also just people that want to understand how the American capitalist economy really functions. So I thank you, Andrew Ross, for being on Law and Disorder, and I appreciate your good work. You have a good new year.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
You take it easy, Andrew.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Died after an 8-month battle with cancer on May 11th of 2016. Today, we dedicate our show and reflect back on Michael Ratner's contribution to the movement and his role in the show Law and Disorder. Heidi, how did you first meet Michael?
Michael, when I started working at the National Lawyers Guild in 1999, I of course knew of Michael's reputation and the many cases he's brought and the various issues that he championed over the years. I first actually saw him at a Columbia Law School event in 1999. I think it was involving Cuba and the embargo. And then in my office, I saw his name everywhere because he was a longtime supporter of the Guild in many respects and was universally loved, respected, admired, and seen as a mentor to many new generations of young radical attorneys and legal workers. Then you called me in 2004 and invited me to be a part of this show. And so I really started to get to know Michael, the person, that year, and remember soon after attending an award ceremony at Columbia Law School where he got their Public Interest Law Foundation Award in 2005 and also the Columbia Law School Medal of Honor. And from there, as Law and Disorder took off, it's just been a mixture of really rare, serious, thoughtful interviews, interactions with a lot of good humor thrown in. The humanity also that Michael brought, unexpected surprises. I remember once after speaking about my Armenian grandfather and mother escaping the genocide, a few weeks later a big box arrived from Amazon with no name on it, and I opened it up and it was a really heavy, complete anthology on the Armenian genocide, and I quickly realized Michael had sent it without a note, just a very thoughtful, generous person. Michael, I know that you go back far longer than I do with Michael, so I'd like to hear how you first met him, but I also know that he had an interesting take on the rule of law.
A take that we all share, but I first met him when I lived around the corner from him in Greenwich Village back in the early 80s. And Michael had just gotten elected as the president of the National Lawyers Guild. And he walked around the corner and schlepped up 4 flights of stairs to our walk-up where I was living with my wife, Debbie, and our very young son, Eli. And he asked me if I would be on the editorial board of Guild Notes, which was the Lawyers Guild magazine. I
said, sure, I'd like to do that. And that's when I started working with Michael. Michael's conception of the law, American law, well, he initially started out, I guess like we all did, Heidi, thinking that the law was a civilized way of resolving disputes. And whatever defects it might have, those could be fixed. Well, he quickly realized that that was not the case. And he came to understand that the law was a method of social control exercised by the 1% over the rest of us and exercised by any means necessary for as long as possible so they could keep their privileges and power. And that was the perspective that Michael had throughout his entire adult life as a litigator. He wanted to expose the law, undercut the law, change it if he could, change it in tandem with the movement because he thought that lawyers in the final analysis played an auxiliary role and that it was the people's movement that caused social change. But he thought that the movement could make use of the law, and he wanted to be an instrument in that endeavor.
Michael, we had a lot of fun over the last 14 years, and I will cherish these memories. We've been likened here on Law and Disorder by a few as the car talk of legal affairs show. And I also remember when I got an award from the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild in 2011, you and Michael introduced my getting that award and were as humorous and insightful and really magnanimous as you always have been on the radio show, and I thought that sort of summarized the kind of working relationship we had.
We weren't that magnanimous. You did a good job. You ran the Guild for 15 years, and the Guild caused a lot of trouble under your tenure, Heidi.
I hope you mean good rabble-rousing.
But, you know, I think we should say something about some of the cases that
yes.
Michael handled and talk about how he came to do what he did. He came from an upper-middle-class Jewish family in Cleveland, went to Brandeis, which was a fairly radical place in the 60s. You know, Herbert Marcuse, the famous philosopher, was there. He was a classmate of Angela Davis's. When he got out, he was accepted to Columbia Law School. He wasn't all that political then. He devoted his first year exclusively to studying, did pretty well, came out first in his class, went onto the law review.
Not surprising.
But what changed him was what happened when the police attacked the students at Columbia back in 68. Columbia had been expanding its campus into the Harlem area. It wanted to build a gymnasium with two entrances, one for the privileged Columbia students and one for the Harlem population. And it was also extensively tied up with America's prosecution of the war in Vietnam. So the students held a sit-in, and the Columbia authorities called the cops on the sit-in. Michael was caught up in that, beaten up. 700 people were arrested. 200 people were sent to the hospital. The National Lawyers Guild came and defended those students.
That became really the beginning of their well-known mass defense program, and they've been defending people in the streets of protest ever since.
It certainly did. I mean, the Lawyers Guild was really a victim of the McCarthy era, which we were just coming out of even in the 60s. And that defense revivified the Lawyers Guild in New York City and then later on nationally. And Michael was on the ground floor of that. So then he went on when he graduated from law school. He worked for the Legal Defense Fund, which was the legal arm of the black movement at the time. Moved down to Baltimore, lived in a motel, did work on school desegregation, came back to New York, got a job with Judge Constance Baker Motley, who was the first black judge in the federal judiciary.
And he always spoke so highly of her.
And vice versa. She thought he was the best clerk she ever had. And then in 71, when he finished his clerkship, he started working for the Center for Constitutional Rights, which was a scrappy, small little organization then. The first week, they sent him up to Buffalo to the Attica prison. Rockefeller was the governor then. Rockefeller wanted to be the president. He didn't want to be looked upon as being soft on prisoners. And when the Attica prisoners took over the prison, the governor called in the state troopers. 43 people were murdered by the state troopers. The Center for Constitutional Rights got in on it and sent Michael up to take statements to try to figure out what to do. And so Michael's first lawsuit was actually called Attica People Against Rockefeller. They tried to get the state to appoint a prosecutor to prosecute the murderers. They didn't succeed on that. But that started Michael off in his political representation from 1971 until 2015.
And Michael, I think for listeners who may not totally understand the nuances of some lawyering, Michael was really a radical attorney, and that's kind of a dying breed. Lawyers who will really take chances. They will take cases because they believe so firmly in the underlying principle and the violations that have occurred that even if the possibility of success in court is very low, they will still take the case to get that message out into the public's eye.
Yeah,
and that, Michael believed in that.
Absolutely. And you know, to work with the movement in doing that.
Yeah.
He didn't believe American law in the final analysis was compatible with democracy, nor did he believe that it was compatible with the rule of law. We saw that most clearly with what happened after 9/11 and the setting up of the offshore prison in Cuba, the creation of a surveillance state, the massive harassment, the militarization of the police, the FBI's spying. But Michael understood that fundamentally. He knew that the rule of law and democracy was not compatible with capitalist law. And he knew that capitalism wasn't compatible with an egalitarian society. And it was that understanding, I think, that empowered him in the litigation that he undertook.
Michael was also an activist, as I think we all are on the show. He opposed Abu Ghraib torture and prisoner abuse, as well as the Iraq War. He served as an expert witness at a mock tribunal staged by the Bush Crimes Commission at the Columbia University. More recently, in May 2014, he resigned from the advisory board of the International Center for Ethics, Justice, and Public Life at Brandeis, where, as you said, he went to school, because the university's president cut ties with Al-Quds, a Palestinian university, after a student demonstration there. So that's who Michael was. If he saw an injustice, he would do something about it.
No, he was in total solidarity with the Palestinian people. In fact, he organized and got the financial support to set up Palestine Legal, which is fighting back against the repression of,
right,
of Palestinian
with the New York,
students.
With the National Lawyers Guild.
Absolutely.
Right. That was very important and still is.
I think that if you want to look back at some of his most significant cases, Heidi, he sued Ronald Reagan for the funding of Contras in Nicaragua,
right,
and for invading Grenada. He sued George Bush 41, the first one, for invading Iraq without congressional authority.
Mm-hmm.
He sued Bill Clinton for warehousing Haitians with HIV in the offshore prison camp, which we now know as Guantanamo.
He served as special counsel to Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, assisting in prosecuting human rights crimes.
He sued the Secretary of Defense under Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, for torture. He sued Indonesian generals, a Guatemalan defense minister who he served when the guy was being given a degree at Harvard. He sued a Haitian dictator, all for human rights abuses.
And he tried to get Clinton to stop the strategic bombing during the Kosovo War.
He sued the FBI for spying on Central American Solidarity activists and CISPES during the 80s. He sued the Pentagon for restricting press coverage of the Gulf War.
He won a case on behalf of victims of the Bosnian Serb leader for war crimes.
And he organized what they called the Guantanamo Bar Association, which was the greatest mass mobilization of lawyers the country's ever seen. He got 500 lawyers to come in after they won the case of Rasul versus Bush, which established that the prisoners in the offshore prison camp in Guantanamo had the right to habeas corpus. They had the right to challenge their detention. They had the right to go in front of a court and tell the judge I don't think I'm being held legally. Let's look into this. A habeas corpus. The fundamental, it's written into the U.S. Constitution. And he restored the habeas corpus and then organized 500 lawyers to continue with those cases. They didn't totally win, but they got 500 out of some 700 prisoners out of there.
A Herculean task.
You know, and we should also mention that he was the president of the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights,
right,
which is kind of the European version of the
CCR.
CCR, yeah.
And I think when it all comes down to his legacy, he will be remembered as a compassionate, loving, really humanitarian attorney who was really loved by all who knew him.
And that sea of people, which includes you and me, Heidi, and our producer, Jeff Brady, who he influenced and continues to motivate. I wanted to say something about Michael in perspective, because Michael Ratner had no funeral. He wasn't religious. Religion to him was superstition. Being part of a sect was too narrow and confining. The Jewish heretic who transcends Jewry belongs to a Jewish tradition. The historian Isaac Deutscher had a phrase for it, the non-Jewish Jew. Michael Ratner was in line with the great heretics, rebels, and revolutionaries of modern thought, Spinoza, Heine, Marx, Luxemburg, Trotsky, Freud. They all went beyond the boundaries of Jewry, finding it too narrow, archaic, constricting. I don't wish to stretch the comparison. Michael was not so much a radical thinker as a man of action. But his intellectual understanding, and he was extremely well-educated, powered his activity. He had in common with these great thinkers the idea that for knowledge to be real, it must be acted upon. As Marx observed, hitherto philosophers have only interpreted the world. The point now is to change it. Like his intellectual predecessors, Michael Ratner saw reality in a state of flux, as dynamic and not static, and he was aware of the constantly changing and contradictory nature of society. Michael was essentially an optimist and shared with the great Jewish revolutionaries an optimistic belief in humanity and a belief in the solidarity of humankind. One of the last times I saw Michael, I was in a singing class with his son Jake and Jake's companion Elena and his daughter Anna and our friend Jennifer Hobbs and my wife, Debbie. We took a class on the Upper West Side called Anyone Can Sing, and we were attempting to learn how to sing, and we thought, you know, we'll put Michael on FaceTime and we'll sing his favorite song. Michael's favorite song was the Internationale. And he was home, just out of the hospital, sitting in a padded Barca lounger-type chair in his living room, laying back and looking at us on FaceTime, and we were looking at him through the iPhone, and we sang the first verse, "Arise, ye prisoners of starvation, arise, ye wretched of the earth, for justice thunders condemnation, a better world's in birth." And we could see him smiling, laying back in the chair. Then we sang the second verse, "No more tradition's chains shall bind us, arise, ye slaves, no more enthrall, the earth shall rise on new foundations. We have been naught, we shall be all." And Michael was really smiling by then. And then we sang the last verse, and that verse is, "'Tis the final conflict, let each stand in their place. International humanity shall be the human race." And when we sang the last verse, Michael raised his right fist, and he sang along with us in French.
In the next former update, Michael Ratner discussed how Israel continues to slaughter innocent Palestinian civilians using disproportionate force. It's called the Dahiya Doctrine. The Israelis are practicing what they call the Dahiya Doctrine. What is this?
Well, at least many of us believe, and I think they are, practicing what's called the Dahiya Doctrine. For all our listeners, it's D-A-H-I-Y-A, and I like to call, when I talk about this, the Dahiya Doctrine, WikiLeaks, and Julian Assange, because the first cable that illustrated what the Dahiya Doctrine was or is came out of WikiLeaks. And it has to do with the way Israel fights its wars against Palestinians or others. Dahiya was a section of Beirut in Lebanon. And what the Israelis did in the 2006 war is they leveled that section entirely. Everything, every building, nothing stood. Disproportionate force is, of course, a key guideline to whether you're committing a war crime or not. It's a war crime to use disproportionate force. If you want to kill an enemy soldier in a neighborhood, you can't kill 10,000 civilians to kill one soldier. You can't kill 100. You have to use what's called proportional force. You can't go after civilian objects. You can't go after civilians or civilian homes. Well, the Dahiya Doctrine is what Israel actually practiced in 2006, leveling a neighborhood, a form of collective punishment, a form of what Israel is saying, we're going to do to anybody that attacks us. We're going to show them it's not simply an eye for an eye. It's your entire body. It's your whole infrastructure. It's everything. That's 2006. Right after that devastation, demolishment of a village in a part of Beirut, rather, a general from Israel said, what we have now is the Dahiya Doctrine. And it's not just a proposal. That's what we do. And he actually said, we will use disproportionate force when we're fighting these wars. So that's an open and notorious admission of a war crime.
It's called party admission.
It's a party admission from a legal term. But yes, it's basically saying we're committing a war crime. Because if you look at the Geneva Conventions, it says you can't use disproportionate force. And here you have a general saying, we're going to use disproportional force. And that's not a proposal, he says. That's an approved doctrine. So now we flash forward to this recent war, if you want to call it that, the recent massacre that took place in Gaza. And, of course, we've been reading about what's going on there, and you look at the statistics from the Palestine Committee on Human Rights, for example. 2,168 people have been killed, 2,168. Of that, 76.6% are civilians. Three-quarters are civilians. Of that, 30% of the civilians killed are children. 23% overall are children. So of this 2,168, 24% roughly were children. So that's what you would call the practice of the Dahiya Doctrine, the overwhelming use of force, disproportionate use of force, that winds up killing way more civilians than appropriate military targets. Now, the second part of that, of course, is a report that came out of the United Nations recently. Someone named Pernille Ironside, who's in charge of UNICEF for the UN, and she's been spending her time in Gaza, gave a very important press conference last week about the damage that's going on in Gaza. And the statistics were completely numbing. The main one that I take away from it is 400,000 people have been displaced in Gaza. That's basically one out of four people have been displaced, one out of four of a population of 1.8 million. Of that, 17,000 houses have been destroyed, 100,000 people completely homeless in Gaza. How long will it take them to rebuild that, assuming they ever get to rebuild it? She says a minimum of 18 years to rebuild it. So what you've seen is the utter and complete use of disproportionate force in Gaza, the Dahiya Doctrine. And I want to just close this segment to say, why are we standing by and allowing this to happen? Here we have a war crime being committed in front of our faces, admission by Israel it's doing it, a disclosure by WikiLeaks showing again the importance of WikiLeaks, and who's in prison or in exile or in an embassy? Julian Assange for exposing this type of document while the people committing these war crimes are going scot-free. And they're going scot-free for one major reason, and that's because the country we live in, the United States, gives them its full support. They can commit war crimes, and there's nothing or very little that people can do about it, at least in any of the so-called agencies, whether it's the UN or the UN or the UN courts or international courts. So the tragedy here is one, that obviously Palestinians are being killed en masse. Secondly, that war crimes are being committed openly and notoriously. And third, that the country, the United States, that we live in is the fundamental supporter of those war crimes. And by that, I want to say, by that, every single member of Congress and the Senate and the House, and Obama, who's approved it, who voted to continue to aid Israel in carrying out these war crimes, which is what that aid is doing, the military aid, is an aider and abettor of war crimes. Absolutely not any question under international law. So the key here for us in America, certainly, is to get the U.S. To stop its criminal support of Israel.
One of the last times I saw Michael, I was in a singing class with his son Jake and Jake's companion Elena and his daughter Anna and our friend Jennifer Hobbs and my wife Debbie. We took a class on the Upper West Side called Anyone Can Sing, and we were attempting to learn how to sing. And we thought, you know, we'll put Michael on FaceTime and we'll sing his favorite song. Michael's favorite song was the Internationale. And he was home, just out of the hospital, sitting in a padded Barca lounger type chair in his living room, laying back and looking at us on FaceTime. And we were looking at him through the iPhone, and we sang the first verse, "Arise, ye prisoners of starvation, arise, ye wretched of the earth, for justice thunders condemnation, a better world's in birth." And we could see him smiling, laying back in the chair. And then we sang the second verse, "No more tradition's chains shall bind us, arise, ye slaves, no more enthrall, the earth shall rise on new foundations, we have been naught, we shall be all." And Michael was really smiling by then. And then we sang the last verse, and that verse is, "'Tis the final conflict, let each stand in their place, international humanity shall be the human race." And when we sang the last verse, Michael raised his right fist, and he sang along with us in French.
Michael Ratner, I'll really miss you. Bye-bye.
I was dreaming, in my dreaming, well of an aspect bright and fair. And my sleeping, it was broken, but my dream, it lingered near. In the farm of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized. And my senses newly open, 'cause I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the world from fools. Upon the meek, the grace to shower. It's decreed that people rule. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Vengeful aspect became suspect and bending low as if to hear. And the armies ceased advancing because the people had their ear. And the shepherds and the soldiers, where they laid beneath the stars, exchanging visions, a laying arms to waste in the dust, in the form of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized. And my senses newly opened, 'cause I awaken to the cry. Come on. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Where there were deserts, I saw fountains, and like cream, the waters rise, and we strolled there together, when none to laugh or criticize, and the leopard and the lamb lay together, truly bound hoping to recall what I had found. I was dreaming in my dreaming, and God knows a pure view. As I surrender into my sleeping, I commit my dream to you. Come on. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. The power to dream, to rule, to wrestle the world from fools. It's decreed that people rule. It's decreed that people rule. Listen, I believe everything we dream can come to pass through our union. We can turn the world around. We can turn the earth revolution. We have the power. People have the power. The people have the power. The people have the power. Thank you. Don't forget it. You have the power. Use your voice. And when you break one acoustic guitar string, it's good luck. We broke two. Be positive.
There you have it. Law and Disorder, the latest. Well, it's still going on, and Kevin McCarthy has now lost his eighth vote. That's right. We will go to a live. Feed from provided by the Midas Touch podcast crew. They're using C-SPAN. You can always go to C-SPAN if you want to watch it without us. But we're going to go live to the House of Representatives, courtesy of the Midas Touch podcast crew, who offers, I think, some of the funniest, if not the best, commentary, and they give you good background on people who are voting, which I really enjoy. So I'll check the phone line. You can call in, contact, and comment on your own if you wish. Actually, I'm going to have lunch. So I'll check back in about 20 minutes. As we listen to this live stream from the Midas Touch podcast crew. Midas Touch also sponsors Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's former lawyer who did 3 years in prison. Michael Cohen, cool. Anyhow, here we go, and I'll be back with you in a while.
Passed the baton to Hakeem Jeffries weeks ago in the proper style that a leader would pass the baton to another leader. Now, in the Republican Party, if Kevin McCarthy, which he doesn't appear he will, if he ascends to the speakership, but whoever becomes speaker will be the highest office that Republicans hold in our federal government. They will essentially be the office holder of the party, the leader of the party, last party leader, the Cheeto Dust QAnoner down at Mar-a-Lago. I like to refer him as Grandpa Poopy Pants as well, would have done a decent, effective job of passing the baton to Kevin McCarthy. He did not. He would not. Well, I mean, he can't even decide if he wants ketchup on his burger or on the wall. Why would he be able to decide who he wants the leader to be? And that is why we have this situation. But Hakeem Jeffries, because the Democrats are effective, because Nancy Pelosi was an effective leader, and she effectively passed the baton to the new effective leader of the Democratic caucus. They are staying fast. They are getting the 212. They are not walking away. We've seen the funny bad lip reading of AOC with Matt Gaetz and also with Paul Gosar. But I believe, and she let the cat out of the bag, I guess, with the conversation, that the conversation was that Matt Gaetz is like, yes, aren't you guys going to come vote? And Kevin McCarthy says this is going to happen and there's going to be a consensus. And AOC essentially told him no. Absolutely fucking not. It is going to be 212 for Hakeem Jeffries every single time because we have effective leadership and you do not. It is your responsibility to America, to your constituents, to get your act together and to pick a Speaker of the House. You're the majority. It is your responsibility to govern, but they can't. They cannot.
They can't handle their responsibility is the truth, and now another vote trickles in where it currently stands. The vote is 68 McCarthy, 75 for Jeffries, 4 for Donalds, and 3 others, and 0 presence. I want to clarify my counting error from earlier that we're coming up on the eve of the second anniversary of the January 6th.
There we go.
See, I'm not very good at counting, fellas, but
my
at least I'm
brothers are not great at math, but we're pretty
solid
when it
comes to math. At least I'm a better counter than Kevin McCarthy.
Ooh.
Who was unable to count the votes here. I want to bring up a little blast from the past. Don't get too excited, folks. This is from October 8th, 2015, when Donald Trump used Twitter. A blast from the past here. Donald Trump tweet from the speaker race at the time. Great, he said. Kevin McCarthy drops out of speaker race. We need a really smart and really tough person to take over this very important job. Donald Trump, man, is there anybody else whose words could be used against him more than Donald Trump? The guy just does – he just kind of is off the cuff, too. You talk about him, Tony, as somebody who is thriving in this chaos, and I bet to some extent he does like it because Donald Trump is a human bulldozer. Everything he touches, as Rick Wilson has said, everything Trump touches dies. Everything Trump touches, he destroys.
I have a different phrase. I say everything Trump touches turns to liquid shit, because truly he is at the heart of this chaos. I mean, Lauren Boebert would not have come to the floor yesterday and said what she said if he wasn't. She would not be able to be invited on Sean Hannity's show and to be questioned about it if Donald Trump. Do you believe for a moment that Donald Trump does not have Sean Hannity's personal cell phone? Do you believe for a moment that Donald Trump does not have Lauren Boebert's ear as with a single ring of his telephone? Do you believe that Kevin McCarthy – if Donald Trump called Kevin McCarthy right now on the House floor as they were voting, he would scurry out to take the phone call.
He is absolutely
at the heart of all this chaos.
100%. And he loves it. He thrives in it. And what we're just seeing is really – it's just a mockery of our entire system of government. I think it also exposes, you know, yet another flaw of one of our institutions, which if – I could say one positive thing about Republicans over these last few years is they have really shown us the problems with the loopholes in our system that allow this sort of chaos to go on. Perhaps we need to find a better way after a few votes. Maybe the rules have to change. Maybe it has to become a plurality – as I pitched yesterday, maybe it's like World Cup rules where it becomes a penalty kick. I don't know maybe it's Hakeem versus McCarthy for penalty kick for speaker. I don't know who's the goalie. Maybe we bring in the Senate parliamentarian or something, or the House clerk could do it. I don't know how you do the rules there, but there's got to be something.
You could set up cornhole boards right there on the House floor
the
and play a game of cornhole and see
here's the
you,
thing.
Who can win.
This is humiliating. This is humiliating for the Republican Party. You know how they always talk about draining the swamp? They are the swamp. If you're one of these MAGA voters, too, you have to be just so confused personally about who to be mad at these instances, Brett, because to your point, it's become a circular firing squad with these Republicans because all of a sudden now they're all rhinos, and everyone's calling MTG a rhino because she's backing McCarthy. Now people are calling Boebert a rhino because she's voting for Kevin Urn. Now everybody in the Republican Party, to their standards, is what they call a rhino, Republican in name only. This is one of the most pathetic displays that we have ever seen, put out live for the world to see, broadcasted live for everyone to see, and just be embarrassed. This is, there's no other feeling than that, Brett, for me. It's, this is an embarrassment to our country that these Republicans are allowing this to happen.
Well, Donald Trump famously lost at least 63 lawsuits related to the 2020 election. So perhaps Kevin McCarthy right now is on a speed run to try to be just as big of a loser as Donald Trump. And so far it seems that he is succeeding with flying colors in that regard. You have Kevin McCarthy now with 88 votes. Hakeem Jeffries with 90 votes. You have Donald's now with 7 votes and 3 votes for others. At least a couple of those votes, I believe, are for Donald Trump, with Lauren Boebert voting for Kevin Hearn. And with that also, that means Donald Trump is officially a loser in all of these rounds as well. Donald Trump now is going for his second defeat for House of Representatives. 0-2. I mean, this total thing is a complete and utter clown show brought to you by the Republican Party. This is who they are. This is how they will govern. This is how they did govern. You see there, Hakeem Jeffries placing the vote for himself to applaud Hakeem Jeffries. What a superstar, Hakeem Jeffries. I mean, who looks better right now, genuinely, than Hakeem Jeffries? Coming out, saying all the right things, throwing punches, calling out this insurrection, this clown show for what it is, day in and day out, already unifying the Democratic Party. Tony.
Can I say one more thing about Hakeem Jeffries, other than the guy is spot on every time? He understands national narrative. He understands messaging. I love this guy. But one thing that is that the Republicans don't know that they're doing in all of this, they do not see it because they don't see past their nose. They don't understand that when pro-democracy coalition out there, the people that we speak to, the audience we speak to every day, when they go in 2024 and they elect a Democratic majority in the House, do you think for a minute, I mean a millisecond, that Hakeem Jeffries isn't going to look back, be able to look back on all these votes and say, here's your evidence of why I'm the Speaker of the House?
Oh,
and
yeah.
when in the first ballot, probably in the first 45 minutes of the House, and being an effective leader immediately, they have no clue.
Such a good point, Tony. And save this clip of you saying that. Let's save this clip and revisit it when Hakeem Jeffries becomes Speaker of the House in one vote. Because that is exactly what we will see once Democrats take back the House. And it looks like right now, it looks like Republicans, they might as well just give Democrats control of the House if they aren't up for the job. I think, you know, Republicans got into these positions in many regards through the heavily gerrymandered areas with illegal maps, especially in Florida. We saw in New York the gerrymandering, which allowed these people to come in. We saw fraud, people who just flat out lied to get elected, like George Santos, get in. Their margin is razor, razor, razor thin. And the people who did vote for the Republicans in that incredible midterm rebuke of the Republican Party, the people who did vote for them, I think some of them might have said, hey, you know what? I want the two sides to come together, okay? I want to have some sort of block. I don't want one party in charge of it all. Maybe if we have Republicans, maybe we'll have some order. Maybe it's a awful, ridiculous mindset that does not play out in reality. But, you know, I'm trying to envision some of the thoughts right now that people may have, okay? Now, what we are seeing is these voters have got to be looking at the Republican Party and going, oh, my gosh, what did I do? Who are these people? These people aren't fit to do anything. These people are not fit to govern.
You know what you call those? You know what you call those, Brett?
Tell me.
Republicans.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we've said time and time again, we have said Republicans are unfit to govern. Republicans are great at throwing shit at the wall. Republicans are great at riling people up, getting people angry. There was a clip we played on the Midas Touch podcast a few weeks back of Bill Clinton saying they just want to get you really mad. They want to get you mad and angry and yeah, I'm so mad. And then they want you to say it's the other people's fault. But now with them being the leaders of the House of Representatives, with this the ball in their court, they have nobody to pin this on. And Tony, to your point about Hakeem Jeffries, we speak about a power vacuum, right? The Democratic Party, for all intents and purposes, could have had a power vacuum. We did have a power vacuum with Speaker Pelosi stepping aside for a new leader to come in. Anytime that happens, there could be incredible infighting for the heart and soul of the party. But what did the Democrats do? They quickly united behind Hakeem Jeffries. Incredibly smart, and shows the unity and shows that the Democrats are taking this seriously in going forward. What did Republicans do with that power vacuum? Well, first, we could go with this power vacuum. They haven't had power for years and years and years. The initial power vacuum allowed somebody like Donald Trump to come in, co-opt the party, show the American people what this party really is, how despicable this party really is, pulled the worst of society up to the forefront, the dregs of society, bring them to the surface, and show just how disgusting, how despicable, how unprincipled the Republican Party is. Now we have a new power vacuum, also as a result of them never fixing the initial power vacuum, with now them trying to figure out who is going to lead the House, and they can't decide. And that's the problem. They don't have an answer. And Kevin McCarthy has basically given as many concessions as possible. Like, Kevin McCarthy has told them, basically, like, listen, if you want to fire me any day of the week, okay, you can bring it to a vote any day, any day. That's what you want. One person could say, I don't like you, Kevin, and that will be my next 2 years at least.
Only one? There's like 25 of them that hate his guts. I mean, even Lauren Boebert said in that clip last night that, look, there's 20 of us that are voting are never Kevin, is what Jordy said. But
yeah,
but there's more of us that, there's more of us that feel that way, just aren't voting that way. I mean, I don't know if I can believe Lauren Boebert further than you could, you know, toss her. But I don't know. I think maybe she's telling the truth there.
Yeah, no, I think there are a lot of people who never Kevin. And the issue is this: the Republican Party really isn't about policy.
No,
they're not policy wonks here. So it's not an issue of
policy. What's policy, though? I mean, how important is policy when you have policymakers and you have a Congress and a legislator that have to, I don't know, appropriate funds to run a country and a government and the military and, you know, all these things that happen, like roads and
bridges. By the way, how genius is it that we passed that on a bipartisan basis, the omnibus bill, through the Senate? That's why the Senate said just last week before they to this new Congress. That's why that one senator, who I'm drawing a blank on his name, he basically said, you know what, we cannot give the House Republicans, they cannot handle the burden of governing. So
to give Mitch McConnell credit, but Mitch McConnell knew for sure that there is no way, because Mitch McConnell knows that Kevin McCarthy is an ineffective leader. He's watched him as his mirror image in the House for the last 2 years. And Kevin has had his ass kicked by Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats at every move and every turn. And the one reason why is, there's two, but and Nancy Pelosi is the most effective, and Joe Biden also knows how to count votes, because that's the thing. Like, literally at the bare bones of the speakership, you have the Rules Committee that establishes the rules for the House floor that gets business done, and you know how to count. Like, those are the two prerequisites of a fucking speaker, is Rules Committee counting. And he can't do either. He can't get the rules right to get his caucus together, and he can't count the numbers that he has to get the vote. So it's not surprising that Kevin McCarthy is a typical Republican like George Santos.
I just want to go back there.
I just want to say before Jordy, there's another vote for Donald out there, which brings Donald's tally to 9. Jordy.
I just want to say here, you know, I think there are a lot of folks that say that the Donald Trump endorsement doesn't mean anything, and I want to disagree with that point, because it means something. It just doesn't mean what it used to.
Yes.
It's kind of a kiss of death these days. If you get endorsed by Trump, you can assure yourself that you're going to keep losing, as we see here playing out by McCarthy, because – you know, by those standards of what that used to mean, when Trump would throw his weight behind somebody, everyone would fall in line. You know, all those Republicans, all those MAGA Republicans. But you're not seeing that anymore, because the guy is just an utter embarrassment. Every time Kevin McCarthy loses this vote, I want our audience to really understand this. It's another loss for Donald Trump. It's an ego shout to him. And you just know he's at Mar-a-Lago, Brett and Tony, just like so steaming and upset and just angry.
Well, you want to know what he's posting? Do you want to know what he's posting? I have Trump Social up here, right here.
Has he posted recently? Has he posted?
28 minutes ago, he posted a link of a Fox News article. Well, this should be riveting. He posted a link. The headline is, Trump vows to deploy U.S. Special Forces military assets to inflict maximum damage, I'm sure. I don't know. It doesn't, as if he's the president of the United States or something. Okay, wow. the next one, 27 minutes ago. Breaking, here's the, it's from the Post Millennial, which is even more garbage. He posts a link. Trump announces plan to destroy drug cartels. So he's posting articles about him being the president that he's not. I can't figure this out.
And Trump's plan to get rid of the drug cartels. I'm sure I clicked that article because I've heard him say.
It's to literally bomb Mexico.
That's his grand plan. You know, what we're witnessing right now is one of the biggest humiliations of the Republican Party. I mean, you know those signs that they have at some businesses that's like, you know, 376 days since our last accident, or 376 since we last lost the case. You know, like, you could set that sign, like, the amount of days since last humiliation of the Republican Party. And every single day, you're like, oh, I'm just going to have to pull that one down.
Here's the
Trump vows to deploy U.S. special forces military to inflict Mexico. Yeah, so he's speaking about bombing Mexico to deal with cartels, which is why this guy, another vote for Donald. That brings Donald's tally now up to 111 with three people voting for other. But, you know, what I was going to say is that this is a humiliation on the level of when, and probably foreboding, when the House Judiciary GOP inexplicably tweeted out Kanye, Elon, Trump. At the time, people thought it to be just a extremely distasteful, bizarre, weird tweet. Now it almost seems like a curse. They put a hex
hilarious
on anybody who did these things. And Salty, if you could get the Elon Musk tweet up today. We speak about Donald Trump as the kiss of death. But it seems like there's one man out there who's trying Donald Trump's kiss of death, and that's Elon Musk, who this morning at 2:23 in the morning decided to post Kevin McCarthy should be speaker. And as we keep seeing day in and day out, anybody who posits that scenario, no matter how beloved they may be by the far right, by the deranged insurrectionists out there on Twitter or elsewhere, no matter how many times they post that, they get absolutely destroyed. And so we then had to post a follow-up tweet basically saying, oh, I didn't, seems like I touched a nerve there. Well, who do you guys want? Oh, my bad. And you even see this, though, with the Marjorie Taylor Greens of the world. You see people calling Marjorie Taylor Greene a sellout for her backing of Kevin McCarthy. And one of the things that I'm taking extreme pleasure in right now, Jordy, is Marjorie Taylor Greene backing the wrong horse and being called a sellout by all of her followers and getting ratioed on every single tweet. When people were voting for Donald's earlier, Marjorie Taylor, in one of the previous votes, one of the number of votes that are out there, Marjorie Taylor Greene wrote, playing identity politics is not the Republican way. It's not the American way. We should not make decisions based on the color of people's skin, but on the context of their character. How disgusting for her to invoke the words of Martin Luther King Jr. Speaker nomination, character and ability to win and to be speaker. And here's just one of her supporters here in the comments saying, I've been a vocal supporter of yours and donated to your campaign. Oh, bless your heart. Listen to your base, MAGA, and drop McCarthy before we drop you. And I've been watching the response online to Marjorie Taylor Greene. And for those who don't know, when I refer to somebody getting ratioed, what it means is they get a larger number of comments to their post. Usually it means when they're negative comments in comparison to the amount of likes that they've gotten on their post. So you have a lot of people rushing to comment angry things on their post rather than to give it a like and a seal of approval. But all you have to do right now is if you want to go on the health site that is twitter.com and search from rep or search to rep MTG and the phrase sellout, you will see by the thousands her supporters calling her a sellout. I just pulled it up right now, so this is completely random, but here, you have lost the respect of conservative voters. Hashtag sellout. Hashtag swamp. Hashtag rhino. Hashtag uniparty. Conservative voters. Do these people really think that they are conservative. Give me a break. There is nothing conservative about them. Donald's up to 14 votes. McCarthy at 158. Jeffries topping him with 167 votes. Here is another post. You are a sellout. Another post. So why do you support a man proved to be a rhino sellout? Did he promise not to do – I don't know. Sometimes he's, I'm doubtful.
It's hard to read,
from
isn't it?
The United States of America, if I'm being honest. Did you say what I think you just said? What a sellout you turned out to be. You would be better to go lead a spin class at the YMCA Congress. I literally just watched you announce to the American people that you are a political sellout and that you expect everything – and you expect everyone else to be a sellout as well. What a disappointment you have turned out to be. This person used one of the sick green face sickly emojis to describe their feelings towards Marjorie Taylor Greene. And there are thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of comments like that directed at Marjorie Taylor Greene today. And, oh, do I love to see that.
And, Brett and Tony, she became overnight the establishment. Now, all of a sudden, you know, she's used to calling people rhinos or whatever. Now, all of a sudden, she's on the out. And the one thing that is pretty certain about these folks is once you cross them, it's hard to not be viewed in their eyes as not the establishment, as one of their own again. So regardless of how ultimately all of this shakes up, this civil war, this tension within the Republican Party is going to remain a constant in all of this. What do you think, Tony?
Well, I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene is a special case here because she is a Trump Republican. She is MAGA. I mean, she's part of what I call the America First Nazi Party. I mean, she is part of that. That is why I believe wholeheartedly that Trump is playing both sides of Kevin McCarthy here. Because let me give an example. During 2020, we all know that there was a pandemic. I'm sure everyone knows that. And Donald Trump got in front of the microphone every single day for a long time and said really stupid shit. I mean, just the most vile, dumb, gross stuff about the pandemic. Didn't give a hell of beans about thousands of people dying, thousands of people getting sick. Really was destroying the economy in all of it. But he needed a foil. He needed someone to blame. We as a country would have no clue, absolutely no idea who Anthony Fauci was and Anthony Fauci's name if it weren't for Donald Trump having to need someone to blame. Now, we go back to the 2022 midterm, right? Fast forward to it, but we got to kind of go back to it too, is that he's been posting on True Social for weeks about how he's not to blame for the 2022 midterm. It was all someone else's fault, right? It wasn't his. I won. I'm a winner. He's not. He's a loser. We know why the 2022 midterms did not turn out in their favor. But he doesn't care about that. He needs someone to blame other than himself because he doesn't want to look like a loser. So in this moment, when he is pitting Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is a MAGA Trump Republican, she is still going on Steve Bannon's Traitor TV News Network and spewing her lies and continuing this Trumpism stuff. But when she is the key here on the one side of Kevin McCarthy, and then you have the Lauren Boebert and the Matt Gaetz on the other side, which all, if you remember, Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene, they were touring around the country as the America First Nazi Party.
Tony, did you see Marjorie? Sorry, continue on.
No.
But I wanted to know if you saw that Marjorie Taylor Greene on Bannon's show freaking out. We've got the clip.
Bring it up. You're going to bring that clip? Yeah, go ahead, and then I'll finish. I think about Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Took an official position. And I also found out that no one went in there and negotiated anything for me, but I haven't asked for anything for myself. You see, that's the difference, Steve. I'm not in there demanding Marjorie, Marjorie, Marjorie. I'm in there saying for the American people, for the American people, for the American people. And that pisses me off when we have other Republicans in there saying, trying to tell the base. Let me remind you, Matt Gaetz, his first vote in Congress was for Paul Ryan as Speaker. And then he went on and cheerleaded Paul Ryan while I was at home pissed off at Paul Ryan because he was failing President Trump and failing our MAGA agenda. You know Chip Roy, who everybody's saying Chip Roy's conservative? Chip Roy did not object on January 6th to Joe Biden's electoral college votes. No, he voted for Joe Biden's electoral college votes. And let me tell you something else. Chip Roy, you know what else? He set out the vote for the January 6th committee. He did not vote against it. He set it out because he was for it. You want to know something else? There's plenty of people with voting records. Scott Perry, the chairman of our Freedom Caucus, before his general election, he would not vote against the gay marriage bill because he was scared how it was going to affect him in his general election. I'm sorry, that is not courage. That is fear. And he was scared of election results, and he didn't do the right thing. But when the bill came back around that he did not know it was going to do, none of us knew it was coming back after his election.
Let me give you one word to describe this clip. Juicy. I mean, just juicy. Listen, if you don't understand American politics and where these people are coming from, because it's exactly what I'm trying to describe here. Marjorie Taylor Greene is getting phone calls from Trump saying, back Kevin. Matt Gaetz and Boebert are getting phone calls from Trump saying, go against Kevin. Go against him. And the reason why is because they always have to have an enemy because they are inept. They suck, and it sucks to suck, okay? I mean, look at the vote. We were talking about math earlier. He's lost eight times now. Jordy, in a playoff, losing eight times, that's two rounds in a playoff loss, right?
Yeah. You just went 0-for-2 in the championship.
Right.
It's
insanity to me.
I want to also say something that while we were playing that clip I saw, and if this is true, this is what people are speculating. So funny. But what some people are saying is when Lauren Boebert voted for Kevin Hearn, she did so to troll McCarthy by saying, I'm voting for Kevin.
That is not surprising because yesterday
children. That's why it's not surprising because they're children.
Everyone made a big deal out of the clip of Lauren Boebert talking about Trump when she said Trump needs to tell Kevin McCarthy to withdraw. Everyone watched that clip, but they missed the most important part of why Lauren Boebert, I almost called her Lauren Bonehead.
Lauren Bonehead, both work. I mean,
right.
It's accurate.
But Lauren Boebert, why is she such a bonehead? She's been a member of Congress for 2 years. And when she finished that diatribe about Trump and blah, 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 and he needs to get Kevin to withdraw, and he needs to get his party in order, Trump, that is, not who's supposed to be speaker, okay? She says at the end, she says, I yield, is what she said. And the floor stopped. Lauren Boebert said again, I yield. She said it three times, I yield. And I know this is nitpicking, but the clerk had to say back to her, you yield back, ? And she said, yes, I yield back. Because when you yield back your time on the floor of the House, you have to say, I yield back my time. I yield it back. She doesn't even know the simple procedural rules of what words she has to use to move the process forward. She's been a member of Congress for 2 damn years, and she doesn't even know this in the moment. And if you're wondering why it is so confusing that she would stand up and say, Kevin Kern, because I want to vote for Kevin, that is your prime example of how boneheaded this idiot is. And why there is over 500 people in that district that would vote for someone who doesn't even know. She doesn't even know, folks, how to yield back her time on the House floor. The clerk stood there. Now, normally what would happen is there would be another person presiding over the House, and the member would know if they said yield, they meant yield back, but it's a clerk. They have to follow the exact rules. They have someone in the wing. They have the parliamentary person in the wing telling them what to say and what to do in every moment so that it's absolutely correct to the rules.
Like you said earlier, Tony, they're not there to govern.
No.
A lot of these people, like Lauren Boebert, are simply there for fame.
Mm-hmm. They're not serious.
Let's cut just briefly now and let's see what's going on the floor. It looks like Jeffries is soon going to get his 212th Democratic vote for the 8th time in a
row.
Simple
majority.
Let's tune in now to the feed. Let's bring up the volume there.
Mark. Present.
So you have a present vote there. Donald's now up to 17 votes, three others, one present. Jeffrey hits the 212th vote for the eighth time in a row, showing incredible Democratic unity. And here's the thing. You have a lot of people, a lot of pundits saying, oh, you know, Democrats should just – what they should do is they should offer – they should nominate Liz Cheney. That's what they should do. They should let's find – why can't the Republicans find a consensus candidate? Okay, guess what, everybody? There is a competent consensus candidate out there right now. It's not on the Republican side. It's Hakeem Jeffries. He's somebody who could actually lead. He is somebody who could actually do the job as Speaker of the House. So perhaps, once again, let's stop calling on the Democrats to solve the Republicans' problem, and let's ask the Republicans, six of them, to find it in their love for this country, if that so exists, to find it in their hearts, in their brains, to just come over and vote for Hakeem Jeffries, because they have proven that they are incapable of doing the jobs itself.
And I think when we look at that, clown emojis, everybody, clown emojis. Santos is on the cam.
He's asking what hallway doesn't have a dead end here, is what he's trying to figure out. He's trying to get a map of the
– When we look at that Steve Bannon, Marjorie Taylor Greene clip, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about before. She goes after Gates in that clip pretty hard, right? So if you're Matt Gates, if you're Lauren Boebert, who then appeared on Steve Bannon's show to rebuke Marjorie Taylor Greene's comments that she made on that show, it's a circular firing squad, like we said earlier in this spot. What we're seeing here is just the total disarray that these Republicans are in. And I'm telling you guys, I'm telling everyone, when we look back at why there's going to be so much chaos and turmoil and hate and division within the Republican Party, one, they're all lunatics, like we all know, but two, we could always pinpoint back to this moment here when they did the vote for Speaker. And they have all these people in the Freedom Caucus, all these crazy lunatic MAGA Republicans taking shots at each other. It is wild. And then that goes back to the other theme that we had talked about, is that they don't want to govern. They want to be WWE characters. They all want that soundbite that's going to get them clicks, that's going to help with their donations, that's just going to help feed just nonsense and division in this country. Because ultimately, what we've said here is they don't care about this country. They would rather nothing get passed to help the American people than allow President Biden to just get his agenda across the board, because they don't care about this country. They love this. They live for this stuff.
Here appears to be the final tally of the eighth round. Yep. No, this is not the movie Groundhog's Day. This is actually happening.
It's a good movie, by the way. It's a good movie.
Good movie.
This is a horrible movie, but is a good movie.
Yeah, I mean, this sure has like a lot of comedy to it as well. Also with packed some drama, and this one's a head scratch. This one's more of a head scratcher than the movie Groundhog's Day. I'll say that. But here are the results of the eighth round, and let's make sure that we put Hakeem Jeffries in the lead here. Hakeem Jeffries, once again, a United Democratic Party taking 212 votes.
You know, I have to say, fellas, it is very impressive. It is very impressive that Kevin McCarthy can still go on the House floor and somehow conjure up a smile on his face.
Right.
He is absolutely destroying his – not just his chance at Speaker, because I get the sense that he's never going to be Speaker. I don't know what you think. But I actually believe that this is going to ruin his seat in Congress.
I don't know how you recover as a congressperson at all.
Absolutely. I would bet you might want to, Salty, put some time stamps on this. Here's another Tony Michaels prediction. I would bet that Kevin McCarthy resigns his seat in Congress in disgrace before George Santos. That is my bet.
That would be so
That
wild.
Is my well, bet.
I will say this, Tony. Mm-hmm. It's pretty incredible. When you are in the same room as fraudster George Santos, and somehow you, Kevin McCarthy, are the biggest fraud loser in the entire room. I mean, how does that not say everything about the Republican Party? We talk about George Santos's lies about who he is, about being a landlord, about running this dog charity, about his mom dying on 9/11, all the lies.
But wait a second.
Kevin McCarthy squatting in the Speaker's office pretending to be Speaker of the House.
But wait. What lie has George Santos told that isn't a typical everyday Republican lie? He just adopted all of them all at once. I mean, that really was George Santos. That was his mistake. Is he was like, hey, I like that Republican lie. I love that Republican. You know what? That Republican lie is one of the best Republican lies I've ever told. I'm going to tell him. And that's really was his mistake, is he didn't pick and choose some of these lies. He was just like, I like all of them, so I'm just going to use all of them. And I'm going to continue to use all of them. Right. He's not somehow – I don't believe that George Santos is somehow outlier in the Republican Party. He truly is the spinning image of the fraud party, like you're saying, Kevin McCarthy, fraud. That's why he can't get the votes. Margaret Taylor Greene, fraud, Boebert, but it goes on and on.
If you were making like if we were talking about the Republican Party in terms of like pies and ingredients for the pies, and you were trying to craft your best Republican pie for a candidate, Santos has all the fraudulent ingredients, all those artificial ingredients that they use. I agree 100%. But perhaps they add too much to this pie.
You know what? You know what pie?
In the oven.
You know what kind of pie we call that where I come from?
Tell me about it.
A cow pie. A cow pie. You know what a cow pie is?
I am aware.
It's a big pile of steamy shit that you find in a cow pen. It is a cow pie. And that is what we're seeing here. Do we have the clown emojis? Is there a shit show emoji at this point?
There is a poop emoji, which also comes up, but to do that as you please.
Oh,
Jeffries, to reiterate, Jeffries 212, McCarthy at 201 votes, Donald's 17, 3 voting other, 1 present. That makes 21 defections for Kevin McCarthy.
Wow.
For sure, Kevin McCarthy is not gaining any friends as this goes on. He is not.
Do we have any news? Do we have any news of are they planning? I mean, that's really what I want to know about tomorrow, because we're going to go through this process either tonight or tomorrow. They're going to adjourn at some point. Democrats are going to let them adjourn at some point and come back, because that's the only two things they can do at this point. They can vote to adjourn and they can vote for speaker. I mean, like, that's their two pieces of business that they can do. They can't do anything else. So we actually do not have a 118th Congress. You do not have a representation in the House of Representatives as we sit right here. If you are a voting member in the United States and you live in a district in the United States, you do not have representation in the United States House of Representatives at this point, because they can't do anything. But I guess my question is, do we know, are they planning, is there any word, are they planning to do the same thing they did yesterday, or are Democrats just going to let them, Kevin McCarthy, just make a fool of himself up to like 20 votes or some shit today? Do we see any of that where someone's reporting? I know yesterday there were several people reporting about the adjournment and then whether they would vote or not last night. But because this is going to be the same thing.
We're going to have the same thing over and over. I think as of now, it appears they're going to a ninth vote, as ridiculous as that sounds. It would be the first time that this has happened since 1923, 100 years ago. That was the vote ended with the speaker at the time in 1923, Frederick Killett, winning on the ninth ballot. I'm not so sure there that Kevin McCarthy will have the same fate there. You have Representative Scott Perry saying now, we're not even really talking about a deal, he said while heading back to the floor. So no deal in sight for Kevin McCarthy, no deal in sight for the Republican Party.
Well, but Scott Perry's the guy who helped lead the insurrectionists to the Capitol to chant "Hang Mike Pence" when they were trying to get a certification of our certified vote, our vote. And they were trying to overturn that. So it's not surprising that Scott Perry is going to look for a deal.
You see Jim Jordan over there with Matt Gaetz. What a crew. I have a
Yucking it up, aren't they?
I'll leave the commentary on them to the comment section here.
I can't wait for the lip read on this one.
I actually think it's genuinely in the Democrats' best interest not to vote for adjournment, just to let this continue to play out. Let the Republicans continue to bash their heads against the proverbial wall. These folks, these Republicans, they're pretenders. They're not contenders, as we mentioned. They don't want to lead. You look at Kevin McCarthy. When he moved into the office, he's pretending to be Speaker. You look at Donald Trump from Mar-a-Lago. He's pretending to be president. These folks don't care. They're fraudsters. They're shucksters. You look at a George Santos, who's just lied about everything, another pretender. But that is the modern day Republican Party, just a bunch of pretenders.
And Jordy, we have some news here coming in from John Bresnahan from Punchbowl News. He's the co-founder of Punchbowl News. He is saying that Republicans are now predicting a ninth roll call vote for Speaker. Oh boy. And then they will try to adjourn. But as he notes at the end of his tweet about this, he says, but we will see what happens, because I don't even think the best Republican source, whoever that is out there, knows what the heck they are doing, because they don't know what the heck they are doing whatsoever. What I do want to highlight for those who may just be tuning in, or for those who may have seen it before, maybe not have the sound up, I don't know, I want to go back to this moment from Representative Catherine Clark, a Democrat from Massachusetts and the minority whip. She gave such an impassioned speech about the vote that was taking place, and I would love to play that. Before we actually get into that, I just want to also say this from Jake Sherman, who says, as of now, lots of uncertainty about what's next. Could be a ninth ballot. House Republicans would like to adjourn, but don't think they have the votes. The leadership operation, who is the leadership operation at this point, who is even referring to, is trying to turn some votes on adjournment now. Remember, they have to keep voting if they can't adjourn. So they can't even, they're not even sure if they have the votes to stop voting, is where we're at with the Republican Party. What a clown show. What an absolute mess. But let's play some positivity while the Republican clown show continues. Let's play this incredible speech on the floor from just moments ago from Representative Democrat Catherine Clark. Play the clip.
We answer the urgent call to protect our planet and invest in clean energy and create tens of millions of good-paying jobs. They said no. When we said women deserve equal pay for equal work, they said no. When we said that childcare and paid family leave should be available to every worker in this country, to every family, they said no. When we secured the fundamental right to vote for every single American, they said no. When we stood by our veterans and expanded their access to health care, they said no. When we defended our democracy 2 years ago tomorrow from a tyrannical president following the January 6th insurrection, they said no. House Democrats will stand together. We will stand for the American people. It is our job and our responsibility to elect a speaker who stands with them, and with great pride, I nominate Hakeem Jeffries.
What a moment there, huh?
Like I said earlier,
that just doesn't show you the contrast
right. That
we see between the two parties. One serious party actually concerned about governing and about leading and about delivering for people, and another who just cares about their own power and about this WWE sideshow. I mean, the things she's speaking about, lowering drug prices, securing voting rights, civil rights, LGBTQ+, rights, getting health care for veterans, cancer-stricken veterans, when Republicans voted against them, defending democracy and actually standing up to the tyranny of Donald Trump and the attack on our democracy on January 6, 2021. What did the Republicans do? As Representative Clark stated, they said no over and over and over again. They said no to the American people. No, we will not lower your drug prices. No, we will not give you marriage equality. No, we will not help you with voting rights or civil rights. No, we will not defend our democracy. We will continue to assault our democracy. That's who these traitors in the Republican Party are. Let's not get it twisted.
Can I add something to that? Because it was Wednesday, yesterday. Yeah, I'm losing track of these days watching these floor votes. Jesus. So yesterday we had David Bender on, great political strategist. He's been around politics for many, many decades. He knows what goes on the House floor. He's watched it. And he called them the party of no yesterday, which it is not surprising that the party of losers is the party of no. But that's truly what they're doing here is they're saying, no, you don't get a speaker. Nope. Sorry, America. You don't get a speaker. Nope. You don't get leadership. You don't get a Congress. You don't have representation. You don't get it. And the reason why is because we're a party of losers and we're the party of no.
Yeah, and we're seeing the party of no in action right now. They can't even, like we said, they can't even vote to adjourn. They're not even sure that they could vote to not vote. That's how incompetent they are. I mean, it's beyond parity what we are seeing here. We see Adam Schiff now having a conversation with Nancy Pelosi there on the floor. Ooh, I would love to. We need a hot mic this the way the sports league's hot mic for players.
Yes.
I need to know what these conversations are at all times because I'm just going to start guessing. This is wild. This is absolute pandemonium. Can't believe that we are potentially heading to a ninth speaker vote, a ninth ballot for Speaker of the House. They could have hashed this out beforehand. They could have gotten together for the American people and tried to figure out a plan, find a consensus candidate, but they have no way forward as of now, as we head on to the ninth speaker vote, Tony.
Well, what I like so much, Brett, sorry to steal it from you there, Tony, but what I like so much there about the clip that we just watched and sort of every time Democrats nominate Hakeem Jeffries for speaker, it's almost what they don't say that is so illuminating to me, right? There's no mention of the regime, right? We're always just stating facts, like situations that actually happen, no hypotheticals here. And then when you listen to the Republicans go off, it's WWE. It lacks common sense. It's just there to stoke anger and division when they nominate either McCarthy or whomever they want to nominate. And they just hog the mic. Like the Democrats, they get up there. They're concise, they're clear, statements of facts. The Republicans go up there, and it's just pure chaos. I mean, just the common theme that we see with them over and over and over again.
Pure chaos as we watch Kevin McCarthy's electoral dysfunction on display for the entire world to see. Kevin
McCarthy. Say that again?
I said electoral dysfunction.
Oh,
I said.
I'm feeling that.
Electoral dysfunction.
You know, I like that Jordy said something about the WWE because I coined a phrase in 2021 on my show, the Tony Michaels podcast. And by the way, I just want to give a shameless plug. If you're not watching my show every single weekday, you're missing out. It's every single weekday, Monday through Friday, noon Eastern, 11 Central, on YouTube, Twitter, and Twitch, and also simulcasting from the Midas Touch Facebook page. So make sure you go to, if you're on YouTube, make sure you go follow the Tony Michaels podcast on YouTube. That would be great if you subscribe, click the bell notifications, because it's every single day for 2 full hours. And tomorrow we're doing Boneheaded Leak, and I can only imagine who the bonehead is going to be.
Oh,
I can't even.
And definitely make sure that you're subscribed to Tony Michaels. I'm going to let Jordy and Tony take it away for the next probably half hour or so.
Great.
I will be back with the continuing coverage here, but you are in good hands with them. Why don't you take it away, guys? And, Jordy, why don't you tell them about Patreon, too, how they could support us, and make sure to subscribe right now to the Midas Touch YouTube channel. And I will see you guys shortly
to continue
the epic humiliation and electoral dysfunction of Kevin McCarthy. See you in a bit.
Great talking, B. Absolutely, folks. If you're here right now, I just want to make it clear. We're not supported by millionaires or billionaires. No, we don't take outside investors because, as we see with the mainstream media, you become beholden to, I guess, like corporate interests and whatever that, just look no further than a certain cable news network that used to be good. I'm not going to call anyone up by name here, CNN. But anyway, patreon.com/MidasTouch. That's how we're able to do all of these streams. So please, if you could go there right now, there are different tiers and levels that you could, you know, interact with us. We do Q&As with the brothers. There's exclusive merch drops. We post exclusive content on there. It's really like a community and a family, just like the Midas Mighty is here on the YouTube channel. So if you can, no pressure if you can't, check us out right now at patreon.com.